Hello, and welcome to Media Industry Conversations. I'm your host, Hannah Wold. This program is part of an ongoing speaker series at the University of Texas at Austin. It's co-sponsored by the Department of Radio, Television, Film, and the Center for Entertainment and Media Industries. This series allows students to meet and hear from industry professionals who share their experiences, knowledge, and thoughts on the rapidly changing media landscape. Thanks to RTF, CME, and our guest speakers, this podcast can now make those interviews widely accessible. This week's guest is Christopher Casanova. At the time of this recording, Christopher was the Vice President of Film and Television at Black Bear Entertainment, where he recently oversaw production for Dumb Money, starring Seth Rogen and Paul Dano. Other upcoming Black Bear titles that Christopher has developed include horror thriller Immaculate, starring Sydney Sweeney, and The Rivals of Amzia King, starring Matthew McConaughey. Since this MIC session was recorded, Christopher has become head of content at Princess Pictures in Melbourne, Australia. Christopher is a first-generation Cuban-American and a native Texan, and earned a Bachelor of Science in Radio, Television, Film from right here at the University of Texas at Austin. Christopher spoke to UT students on October 23, 2023, and the conversation was hosted by Dr. Elisa Perrin. They discussed his career trajectory, the scope of his work as VP of Film and Television at Black Bear Entertainment, and his views on the current state of the media industries.
I am thrilled to welcome another UT and an RTF grad back to campus. Please welcome Christopher Casanova, the Vice President of Film and Television at Black Bear Pictures. And I just want to give a quick shout out of thanks to Hannah Wold, who is our organizer extraordinaire for these events, Christina Bruning, Laura Brown, Paxton Haven, and Maggie McInnes, who help out. And also thanks to the RTF department, especially Cindy McCreary, and Alana Wakeman, and the Moody College of Communication, in particular, Virginia Anderson, Kathleen Mabley, and Dean Rachel Davis-Mercy. And I can't forget Keith Berner. So let's go ahead and dig in now to talking all things film producing, financing, and beyond. To just get us started off, if you can go ahead and give us sort of an overview of what you currently do in your role.
Sure. I am Vice President of Film and Television at Black Bear Pictures. We're a boutique media company. We finance and produce a range of content across film and television. My focus these days is predominantly on the film side of our slate, although I do still have a hand in a few television projects. But I oversee day-to-day on our development slate on the feature side. So that's everything from sourcing packages for us to look at from a turnkey financing standpoint, identifying available material and IP for us to develop from a longer lead standpoint as well, and you know, shepherding it from there on through through the development phases, prep, production, post-production, and working closely with other stakeholders as we take those projects to market to find their homes from a distribution standpoint. So it's pretty full service and a small team, so we wear many hats.
Excellent. That's good. I'm sure we're going to get much more in depth on all this. And actually, it reminded me, I don't know that we've talked about packaging yet in class. So would you mind explaining what you mean when you say that?
Sure. And I guess packaging is like something of a dirty word these days, especially in the post sort of ATA and WGA sort of standoff a few years ago, if any of you might have read anything about that in the trades. But from my perspective, not from the agency perspective, packaging is simply the, you know, the process of putting a filmmaker and putting various cast elements on a project. We're trying to build it in a way that is really balancing what feels creatively right for a project with something that the marketplace can support. And that will ultimately create the right value proposition when it comes to the budget a film needs to be made at. And a cast and a filmmaker that can produce enough value, at least in the eyes of international buyers, to allow us to derive that budget.
Great, thanks. And we'll probably get into some examples of this sort of thing later, maybe.
Great. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But first, we're going to go back in time. And I'd love to just have you walk us through what you thought your initial goals were when you were at UT. Were you interested in working as a producer? How did those interests evolve while you were here?
Sure. I came to UT actually as a student in the College of Fine Arts. I was a vocal performance and choral studies major for a semester before I really freaked my parents out by pursuing something with even less stable career goals. I'm just kidding. But I had always been interested in film and sort of took the plunge after leaving the music school and got into RTF and wasn't really sure exactly what I wanted to be doing, to be honest. I thought about cinematography. I directed a handful of projects. And then I took Richard Lewis's producing class. And something just clicked in terms of like the left and right brain aspects of what the role entails, working closely with creatives, but understanding the marketplace and helping to navigate things from a commerce standpoint as well. And from there, I had the opportunity to, you know, work in something of a producerial capacity on a few graduate student projects. I took Micah Barber's advanced producing class, where we took an even deeper dive into what it really means to make balanced creative decisions. And I think, you know, from there, I just felt like, that was the alleyway I wanted to storm down.
Okay. So you were getting hands-on experience. You were doing coursework that was really helpful. And then you went out to UTLA, right? And was that your first sort of internship kind of opportunity, or had you done ones before that?
I had done a few internships that were a little bit unconventional. I did an internship at Sundance for an agency where I was effectively their bag man, like driving agents from screening to screening, standing out in the freezing cold to get tickets in the day of line. Really unglamorous stuff. And I did a similar internship at Cannes that same year for another agency that imploded moments after I completed the internship. But so I had gotten some experience in that regard, but it wasn't until UTLA that I got really an experience that was a little bit more conventional, I guess, where you have more optics on sort of what the day is, what the day-to-day is like, what the assistants are doing, what the overall business looks like. And I did that with APA, the talent agency, which is now IAG, and with XYZ Films.
So what kind of things were you doing as an intern? What were you learning? How is that preparing you?
At APA, it was like very much just shadowing assistants. I mean, helping with things, with various things in the mailroom, like binding scripts and literally delivering mail. But otherwise just watching assistants work and seeing what it meant to be like sending avails and sending, you know, client materials and like really granular stuff that seems, you know, incredibly unexciting. But I think in terms of understanding and getting ready for what would likely be sort of my next steps in the industry as an assistant somewhere, I felt like it was a nice toe dip into what that looked like. And then at XYZ Films, I was, you know, kept very busy writing script coverage, filing all sorts of international deals in an elaborate Dropbox system. And they were kind enough to really take me in a deep dive through what those contracts looked like and sort of got me excited to look at deals and to sort of wrap my head around them in a way that I think previously your eyes sort of just gloss over at a lot of legalese. And so they were both really valuable in the long term.
Great. Well, that's helpful. So I'm curious, like, how did you make the pivot from an intern to your first job? Like, what was that like? And what did you do?
I honestly sort of tracked down every Texas alum that I could find out in LA while I was there. I played the student card and was just like, hey, you're a Longhorn. I'm a Longhorn. Can I buy you a cup of coffee? And can you spare 5 minutes of your time? Most of them were generous enough to give me an hour. And I sort of just like top to bottom would just pick their brain on their experiences. And most of them, I left those conversations with them generous enough to pass my resume along to agency mailrooms. And so I was able to, I think I interviewed like everywhere, pretty much any place that had a mailroom, of any sort, I was like trying to figure out how to get a foot in the door there. And was lucky enough to, you know, to get a job at WME.
So yeah, talk to me about your experience in the mailroom and then how you moved up in that organization or what that was like.
Yeah. I mean, in the mailroom, as the title would suggest, you're literally delivering people's mail every day. And then you have the completely unenviable job of like pinch hitting for assistants who are out sick and what we called floating. So like a big talent partner's assistant would be out with the flu and you would be their assistant for the day dealing with whatever chaos and tumult, the day had in store for you. Which is a recipe for failure, but I think you develop thick skin in the process. And you're also, you know, I think developing close relationships with like the 12 or so other kids in your mailroom class who become sort of like your cohort, your graduating class, if you will, as you all kind of rise up through the industry together. And every agency is different. At WME, like you get there, you get trained to be on a desk, but then you're in the mailroom until things open up and you interview. And so you don't really have much of a say, I guess, in where you land. Like, they're just going to tell you, hey, this desk is open, go and interview for it. And they're going to pick somebody. I was lucky enough to get, a desk, not in my first choice, which was the Indie Finance and Sales Group, but in the production department where we repped like cinematographers and line producers and costume designers and editors. But they happened to be on the same floor as the Indie Finance Group. And I sat next to, the Indie Finance Division's coordinator, who is like a super assistant who manages all the other assistants, and was able to sort of like show him what I knew. And when a desk opened up in that division, he was a strong advocate for me. And then in a bizarre twist of fate years later, I became his assistant. So it was just one of those things where I wasn't dealt the cards that I wanted, but I was able to figure out like how to play the hand that I had.
So how, like, what was sort of the timeline from like mailroom to assistant? And then did you become an agent trainee next? Was that?
Yeah. I mean, I was in the mailroom for, it was a pretty quick spell in the mailroom for me. Honestly, I was in the mailroom for about 2 weeks. Some people are there for a month. I mean, there was a girl who was there for like 48 hours. Cause she just had like the most impressive CV you could ever imagine and was poached like to go and be Ari Emanuel's third assistant. I was in the production department for about 6 months. I was in the indie department on a partner's desk for about 18 months. And while I was on his desk, I was invited to apply for the agent training program, which you basically just do like a research assignment and you have to pitch to a room of agents and they grill you with questions. And I guess at the time it seems really terrifying, but looking back, it was like, you know, it was like a group project. And then from there, like once you're in the agent training program, they try to shape a little bit more of what you're getting exposed to. So I had worked for a partner and gotten to see like what it's like for, to work for an agent who has their own business. And then they had me go and work for, the coordinator I used to sit next to. He was 28. I think I was 24. So it was a very funny dynamic, and seeing what like a second and third year agent whose job is to cover other projects, other clients, sort of what they were dealing with. And I think that was when I was like, oh, this is not as fun as, you know, like working with the Safdies and Martin Scorsese and Luca Guadagnino. I'm like, I likened it to like the first act of The Wolf of Wall Street when like we're like slanging penny stocks, like, you know, just trying to help move boulders up the hill on projects that we had gotten stuck with for whatever reason.
So was that sort of where you said, I'm going to look at other options in the world?
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So before we move on to talking about your jump to another place, I'm just curious, we've had quite a few people come through who started in the agency path, and sort of what's your thinking about like agency versus other ways that people might enter the business?
I mean, I got a lot out of the agency experience, and I think you have a lot of just like, there's a lot of built-in access to material, to, you know, a broader cross section of the industry in terms of seeing how things are coming together or how they fall apart, how they're brought back to life. But at the same time, I do think that people put maybe a little bit too much stock into that. I mean, certainly there are a lot of entry level jobs in the business that are going to say they want a year or two of agency experience. But I think people put a lot of stock into one of the big three versus a boutique shop versus a management company. And I think, frankly, those resources are only as good as what you do with them. So like, I mean, by way of example, one of my good friends, worked for, you know, a lit agent at a much smaller agency, that was sort of like the butt of a lot of jokes. And if you guys watch Entourage, you could probably guess, what agency that would be. But like, it was a sort of thing that when Ted Hope moved over to Amazon and that was like the hottest job in town, you would have expected him to hire like an Ivy League grad who was at CAA or WME. But my friend Brent just was a real hustler and a great guy and worked really, really hard to build relationships, and the sort of goodwill that would be the wind in his sails to get him that job. And that, you know, is something that like, you don't necessarily you know, it's all what you make of it, I guess.
That's helpful. So speaking of making the jump from an agency, Black Bear was your next stop.
It was. Yeah.
So can you talk about sort of like what factored in and how you started there and like moved up the chain?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I came over on our CEO and president's desk as like a coordinator slash assistant. So it was analogous in some ways in terms of what the work looked like. You know, usual assistant admin of like scheduling and phones and travel. Again, like super unglamorous, but it was a very small team where I did have the opportunity to make my voice heard in terms of my thoughts on material, notes on projects that we had that were in active development, and really ingratiate myself with the team. So it was, and then sort of switched gears to trying to sort of function like the role that I wanted to inherit, which the next step was to be a creative executive. So I started to bring in material. I started to flag filmmakers and become a little bit more central in sourcing opportunities for the company, and did that while also managing the desk and all of those responsibilities until I was treading water and couldn't keep both plates spinning and basically marched into Teddy's office and said, I think we should start looking for another assistant to replace me so that I can like go and actually do this thing that seems to be of value to the company. And he was gracious enough to say, okay. And sort of the executive track kind of took off from there.
So yeah, maybe you can talk a little bit about like Black Bear's profile as a company, sort of what is the orientation? Are there certain types of projects that you all look for and how big is it? That kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, the core creative team is super small. It's myself. I have a counterpart on the television side. We have a head of production and then our president and CEO is very hands-on. But we have a management division, which is rather new, about six or so managers representing 80 or 100 or so clients. We have an international sales division now, which is also somewhat new, headquartered in London, a team of about 20 or 30. They service all of our titles from an international pre-sale standpoint, as well as do third-party sales for a number of other films that I have nothing to do with. And they also distribute directly in the UK and Ireland on a number of projects. And then we also capitalize and oversee a Canadian distribution company called Elevation Pictures, who are the leading indie distributor in Canada. That's a team of about 40. And then recently we brokered a joint venture with Regency in the nonfiction space. And that's a team of two headquartered in New York. So it's like my little purview is very small, but then like it's, you know, upwards of 100 employees globally now, which is crazy because at one point when I was an assistant there, there were four of us.
So back to, you had made a comment about sourcing material. Like how did you do that? Like what is the process of like scouting project, sourcing material? Like how are you doing that for the company?
There are a few different avenues. I mean, it can be anything from just like scouring Texas Monthly for a great article, or looking on Publishers Weekly to see if there's a new book that sounds interesting and figuring out who controls the rights and inquiring whether it's available. But then there's also, you know, I think the more conventional route of receiving material on submission from agents and from managers, and sometimes from writers or filmmakers that we have direct relationships with. And that material could be a spec script like that a writer is just hoping to sell. It could be something from a writer director. It really depends. And then I think there's also sort of like, I don't want to call it an underbelly, but there's sort of like the tracking board, which I don't know if that's anything you and your students have discussed previously.
I mean,
a tracking board is basically like you find a group of your friends, you know, you sort of build your own cohort of assistants. And typically you try to cast a wide net in terms of people who are on the agency side and at various production companies. And I'm sure it used to be like a listserv, but nowadays it's pretty much on Slack. And it's basically just a collective way of helping each other find material that you're hearing is about, you know, is going out around town. It could be as granular as like, hey, I need this person's contact info. Does anyone's boss have it in their Rolodex? Or it could be like, hey, I heard CAA is out with this script and I'm trying to track it down for my boss. Does anyone have it? But that I think became a big, it's like script tracking became a big way of sort of trying to, you know, find the unfindable to sort of impress your boss and show them that you're worthy of sort of taking that next step.
Gotcha. That's helpful. I'm curious, you mentioned that Black Bear is moving into management, and it seems like a lot of companies are sort of building their management arms. Like, how does that work? Like the clients that are managed, what is the relationship between like the, how much is you looking to produce for them?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's twofold. I think that we always want to try to connect the dots in a way that is organic and frankly, in a way that our model can support specifically. But we're definitely looking for those opportunities to sort of break ground with them on deep development from an early standpoint, and are always looking out for things that may be opportunities on our slate that could be right for a certain client. But we're not trying to jam them in or like conversely to glom on and become producers on projects that our clients are participating in just because we represent them. But there's definitely like a middle section of the Venn diagram, if you will, where we are trying to build things with them. And then there are a handful of projects now that our managers are producing that may never become Black Bear equity sort of projects that are just things that, you know, basically independently under the umbrella of Black Bear will produce.
Gotcha. So before we move on to talking more about sort of the scope of your work now, I'm just curious. So you made a jump from so-called creative executive to vice president. Like, what is the transition there from the position of creative executive to vice president in terms of scope of responsibility?
Sure. Sure. I think previously when I was working, you know, under a creative exec title, we had a, there was a more senior executive above me who I was basically reporting to and working in tandem with across everything. She left the company very amicably. I sort of stepped in to sort of fill that gap where I'm working directly with our president and CEO to, you know, to manage the day-to-day on the slate and to, you know, hash out strategy and sort of overall, marketplace decisions when it comes to when we're taking our projects to market, how we're going to do that. So it's a lot of the same work. I think it's just like, I'm doing a lot of it on my own now.
You're more in charge.
I guess you could say that.
Well, I think one thing that might be helpful is to talk a little bit about maybe a case study of a project.
Sure.
And like walk through, like, how would you be involved with it? When would you come in and where and how would you chime in along the way?
Yeah, sure.
And who would you be engaging with?
Sure. Trying to think of the best example since every project's sort of different. This is going to seem like a shameless plug and I apologize. Why don't we talk about our film Naiad that comes out on Netflix in a few weeks. And I think, I don't know if it's in theatrical here in Austin, but it started like a limited theatrical run this past weekend.
Machinery starts talking to
him. No worries. So that was an opportunity that came to us with a producer named Andrew Lazar, who had Diana Nyad's life rights and was looking for a partner to, you know, pay a writer to adapt to script. And so we locked arms with him. We brought on a writer to do a draft of the script. We got it. We worked closely with her on notes. Some of this predates my time. Some of what I'm talking about now predates my time at the company. I joined Black Bear right around the time that we had a script that we felt good about and started to take out to filmmakers, because it always to us felt like something of a director's piece, you know, an experiential story of this woman who at the age of 64 on her fifth attempt completed an open water swim from Cuba to Key West. And so we ended up bringing on Jimmy Chin and Chai Vassarelli, who had just won the Oscar for Free Solo. And they had some really tremendous thoughts about the script, but we all felt like we might need a fresh perspective from a writing standpoint. And so we started to court a handful of writers. We shared the material with them. They all sort of presented us with their take on sort of what they would do and how they would implement Jimmy and Chai's notes. And that led us to locking arms with a really tremendous writer named Julia Cox, who wrote the script that we ended up shooting. We worked closely with Julia over the course of several months to to get the script into a place where we all again felt like it was an adequate reflection of the character of the world of Jimmy and Chai's vision. And we set out to produce it independently, to finance it ourselves. So we cast Annette Bening, felt like we had a tremendous bird in hand in that regard. And, we started to court various department heads with an eye towards shooting it in the summer of, I guess this would have been 2021. So we launched it for international sales in Berlin, February of 2021. With the idea of taking those pre-sales, and using that to go into our finance plan, to get the movie made, that summer. Along the way, the team at Netflix sniffed out the project and came to us with an offer that, was a multiple of the budget that we were going to be able to support it ourselves by whatever divine calculus that they had, arrived at. And so, we decided to lock arms with them, and it was something of an outlier for us at Black Bear in that, they wanted to own and control the project. So we were not actually the financiers. We were just producers for hire for Netflix as the studio. And, again, like the script continued to evolve. They pushed back the production start date, which frankly just gave Annette more time to get into shape, because she did all of her own swimming. And from there, we were involved with everything from, again, bringing on department heads, casting all of the additional roles, script development en route to production, location scouting in the Dominican Republic. And then my colleagues, Teddy Schwarzman and Michael Heimler, were on set. Some combination of them was on set with Andrew Lazar for run of show. And that sort of brings us to today. So sorry, that was very scattershot and long-winded.
I mean, I think it's really helpful. I'm curious. So, when it's for a streamer like Netflix, and I'm assuming like the pre-sales vision kind of didn't happen then, right? Because Netflix covered it all, or?
Yeah. I mean, it's the sort of thing where we might've closed some sales had they not come in.
Yeah.
But when they came in and wanted to buy us out for the world, we were like, great.
So like in terms of thinking about issues like distribution, like, what's going on the Netflix platform. Is there anything really you're thinking about beyond just getting to a final print, final cut of the project? Like,
I mean, I think we're still operating, with the best interest of the film in mind, every step of the way, and trying to protect at that point. We're not the studio and the creative producers. We're just creative producers. So I think we're using some of that, financier brain, to make decisions that will help us keep the film on budget. But ultimately, like, our job at that point becomes protecting their creative vision and surrounding first time feature filmmakers with great department heads and resources, to help them, break ground on their own maiden voyage.
I mean, this is a really good example. I'm curious if you can talk through an example of something that might be more in the traditional kind of theatrical distribution indie finance, just sure. To give students a sense of, like, we haven't even really talked about what pre-sales is. So maybe I think it would be helpful to kind of lay out, like, what would be a theatrically distributed indie finance model? Like, how would you think about that?
Sure. Like through the lens of a specific film of ours, or?
If you want to, or you can give... whether you'd rather do a specific one or talk in more general terms.
Yeah. I mean, maybe just in general terms, so I don't have to get so bogged down in my own brain about specific dates and names. I think, typically what we're looking at, and again, our financing is driven by more of an international pre-sale model. We're looking for great material that feels like, from a domestic standpoint, it can be, noisy and part of the cultural conversation and draw in a wide audience into the room. So like things that straddle that intersection of art and commerce. We see that material through and will be involved in every step of the process from a packaging standpoint, to get that package ready to take to market. So that might mean bringing on, a filmmaker, bringing on cast and the filmmaker may have their own thoughts on the script. And so it sort of becomes a little bit of a cyclical process until everyone feels great about where you are. We'll take it to a traditional market, like Berlin, Toronto, Cannes, Sundance is not really a pre-sales market. South by Southwest is not really a pre-sales market. AFM, which is happening in LA next week, I guess would be another one. Where we take the project, we present it to the marketplace. So there will typically be, and I'm sure if you guys subscribe to Deadline, you'll start to see over the next couple of weeks, lots of like AFM packaging, where you'll see some announcement of whether it's BlackBerry International, my colleagues in London, or whether it's Film Nation or Bankside, you name it. Like they'll be sort of announcing that this new project is being presented to the marketplace. So they will typically share a script, you know, details on all of those attachments. Sometimes there's a promo or a presentation where it's kind of like a rip reel with interviews with everyone involved to sort of give you a sense of the director's vision and sort of the feel and tone of the film and where it's going to live in the marketplace. And the idea there is for international buyers to acquire the rights in advance of production. And then we can take those pre-sales and bank against them as we're putting together the financing for the film. So you would take, you know, you would have some debt against those international pre-sales, potentially against soft money if you're shooting in an incentive state or in an incentive country. And then the rest we would just fill in with our own equity. And from there we can make the movie, and then we really, depending on what the project is, we'll figure out when the right time is to take it to buyers to figure out domestic distribution. And sometimes when you like with NIAID, when you launch the project for international, a worldwide buyer comes sniffing around, or a domestic buyer comes sniffing around, and they'll want to take it off the table. So we launched international sales last year on Dumb Money, and about a week into production, Sony not only wanted to buy a few international territories, they wanted domestic. It really depends. And it's hard to just put like one sort of rote boilerplate approach to it, because sometimes you want to hold on to all of those territories. Sometimes you want to hold on to the world and bring the project to the marketplace on a completed basis where you're really betting that it's going to blow everyone's hair back and that you're going to be able to derive more value at that point in the process than earlier. Sometimes the elements are so shiny and exciting that buyers are willing to pay a premium just based on the idea of it. And you would rather hedge on selling it at that point in its value cycle, as opposed to when it's completed and maybe disappoints. Sorry. I feel like that was another.
No, that's actually, I think it's really helpful. I'm curious. So this pre-sales model has been around for a while now.
It has been. Yeah.
And so I'm kind of curious what, like, just broadly, like, what's your take on it these days with streamers? Like, do you feel like it's as prominent with as many companies doing it, or if things like, what's the marketplace like? And
sure. There's definitely been a ton of contraction in the pre-sales market over the last 5-10 years. I think we are one of only a handful of businesses now that are still advancing money, like, you know, providing a minimum guarantee of the sales that we'll perform, which just makes it easier for producers to, you know, to bank against that. But I think there's been a lot of change in the marketplace, certainly in the age of streaming, where the proliferation of content on streaming platforms has not necessarily translated to a parallel value within the theatrical marketplace. So someone can be a hit on a Netflix series or in a Netflix film, and they can be next to meaningless in terms of their international value for theatrical buyers abroad. And so that's, I think, just made it a lot harder to put together a plan or put together a package, frankly, that feels robust enough to enter the market in that regard. And I think as a result, you know, a lot of time people are trying to figure out an earlier point of transaction with buyers, especially with streamers, where you might take them a project with a script and a filmmaker and then figure out, based on whatever metrics of their platform make sense, the right names, where, you know, an actor could mean everything to Netflix and mean nothing to Amazon.
Wow. Are there certain like tendencies in terms of genre or budget level? Like, right. Like, what is sort of the marketplace in favor of versus not for these kinds of films that you're working on now?
Yeah. I mean, for us specifically, we're focused on a mid-range, you know, I call it a $20 to $40 million budget space, but we finance films as little as under five and upwards of $50 million or more. So I think, you know, within the marketplace, the streamers are certainly getting very aggressive about mid-range packages that have any sort of meaningful talent. And I think what that means for independents like us, who used to see a lot of those projects come by and then we would finance them and then sell them to streamers, we can no longer sort of like build those arbitrage plays or enter, you know, like kind of cherry pick them in a way that we used to. And so we're pouring more of our development resources into long lead development to build a slate of content that can ultimately be that and control our own destiny in a way. But I think like within the sort of macro landscape of the marketplace, those smaller projects, the sub five or sub $10 million level, those are tending to be acquisitions from streamers and not necessarily things that they're looking to take the swing on themselves unless they feel like there's tremendous upside or unless it's like a genre piece, like a low budget horror where they can sort of make it for a price and they know it'll do well on their platform.
I'm curious. So you mentioned that with NIAID, you sold that to Netflix. So is your goal to hold on to rights for a lot of the things that you're financing long-term, or are you usually aiming to sell?
I mean, we're looking to hold on to rights, at least in certain territories where we feel like we can take advantage of the upside. And I think, you know, licensing something on a completed basis where you ultimately own the copyright and you can continue to exploit it in other windows is certainly, when it works, the most lucrative sort of model to employ. Whereas when you're dealing with a streamer, your upside is capped. And so there's just a little bit, your upside is capped. There's less upside. There's less of an incentive from anyone's standpoint, frankly, for the film to cross over. I think we're always looking for ways to sort of exploit things and own that copyright for as long as possible.
I'm curious, so you mentioned, you've said slate several times. So I'm curious, like, what goes into thinking about a slate? Like, how big is it? Like, what's the composition? What factors in there?
It's a great question. We are a little bit different than some other companies. Our slate's pretty lean because at any point, at whatever point we're coming onto a project as creative producers, we're also coming onto it to finance. So we're looking for projects that we can build in a way that our model can support and not so that we're ultimately not limiting factors. If something is so specific or can only be built in a way, you know, that could live on a streamer, then we're building things in a way that ultimately we're not going to be the ones to greenlight the process. We're going to be beholden to somebody else. So that's, I think, the biggest thing we're thinking about as we look to the slate. But other than that, you know, our remit is pretty far reaching. We're genre agnostic. We're looking at a variety of budget levels. I think the connective tissue for us really is finding great characters, unique worlds, interesting perspectives, and things that can make us look and think differently about the world without ever sort of putting those issues like in the forefront where they can get in the way of the emotional journey. And so in that way, I guess, you know, we're fortunate enough to be at a place that's very taste driven without, I hope that doesn't sound too pretentious, but okay. It's finding things that we love and then just figuring out a way to make them.
I'm curious. So, and this is partly just for students that, okay, I'm interested in working in this space. I'm interested in working in film finance and the kind of mode you are. Like you said, there's only a handful of companies that are really occupying the space like right now. Who would you identify as sort of competitors or company? They're looking for internships or that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, in terms of from a foreign sales and financing standpoint, there's companies like Film Nation, AGC, XYZ Films. I think like they're, even though their remit is very genre specific, I know they're trying to branch out of that. And it's a great team over there. Alex Williams, their director of development, is a fellow Longhorn. I think there are, and then, you know, within the creative side, I mean, you know, we really admire the tasted companies like Plan B, who we're fortunate enough to be working with on something right now. The team at Seesaw, are just tremendous. Leyline, who was the team behind Everything Everywhere All at Once. Kindred Spirit is another great sort of like boutique production financier. I mean, there are, I would encourage, if anyone is interested in getting an internship, I would encourage you to just look at the credits of your favorite films, or look at who's representing your favorite filmmakers and sort of reverse engineer a list from there, where you can sort of hone in on people that are doing stuff that you're excited about. And I think, you know, you'll end up with a lot to go from there.
That's really helpful. Thank you. We talked right before class started about how you're starting to move into TV. And I'm curious if you can talk about like how the finance model for indie finance models translating to TV right now.
Sure. And I guess I'll caveat all of this with like, it's not my main area of focus, but I can speak in broad terms. Our TV business is kind of a reflection of how we're working in the film space. So the same capital that we have access to finance scripts and to finance production for features, we are also using to do the same in television. So we can operate as a true studio where we're commissioning script development, where we can originate projects and material that we own. And then we can also deficit finance those projects. So essentially you have like an anchor broadcaster, and I'll just use an upcoming project of ours by way of example. We have a project with Scott Frank that AMC will distribute in North America in Q1 of next year called Monsieur Spade, that AMC has North America on. Film Nation actually is selling international territories and was looking for a partner to come in to finance the deficit on a per episode basis of that budget. So essentially AMC is coming in for X, but the per episode budget is 3X. So we are coming in for 2X times the number of episodes in the season in what is pretty much analogous to an independent film model where once the series is done, we take on a territory by territory basis and go and license those rights, which is can be incredibly lucrative, but is super high risk as well. And there's been a lot of contraction in the television market as of late. I think we'll continue to look for those opportunities, but we also can function in a traditional way where we can just, you know, commission a script and take that to a broadcaster in the US who we could co-studio or just be non-writing EPs with.
That's really helpful. Thank you. And it seems like the indie finance model is been experimented with for like the last decade, but in TV, but not widely used yet. I'm curious in terms of festivals, like how do festivals fit into your scheme? Like you talked about film markets that are tied to festivals, but like where and how do festivals or which ones figure in or which ones matter and how do they matter?
Yeah, I think the two biggest festivals within my humble vantage at Black Bear are Cannes and Toronto. Toronto, because we work very closely with Elevation Pictures, our sister company up there, who tend to have anywhere from like 9 to 12 projects where they are the Canadian distributor and sort of front and center on bringing those projects to the festival and dealing with all the various publicity requirements, etc. But it's also just been a very friendly festival to us, and we've brought a lot of sales titles there. So this year we had 3 films at the festival. We had Dumb Money, we had Naiad, and then we had this little movie called Sing Sing with Coleman Domingo. And so for us, it's both a place for us to launch projects for international, but also to bring completed projects to the market, to find either a domestic or a worldwide partner, depending on how we approach the market before that. And then certainly we're a festival like Cannes is a little bit less of an onus on seeing things and premiering films, but tends to just sort of be a market where buyers, producers, creatives from every corner of the globe end up there. And it's sort of just a marathon of meetings. So just trying to get FaceTime with your preferred partners in various territories, producers that you want to work with, and then sort of take things from there.
Well, I'm curious. So clearly the global market matters a lot to the kinds of projects you're doing. Are there certain territories that are especially important when you're thinking about, okay, we can make a lot of money from these territories, or you prioritize or hold back the rights for those?
Yeah, I think, again, it depends on the genre, and it depends on some of the elements. Like we might have a project where someone's super valuable in Spain. We might think strategically about holding off on that, and because if it's really, if the project ends up really good, then we can extract more value there. I think the historically the ones that we tend to look to hold back on to maximize value are just the other English language territories. I mean, we distribute in the UK, so that really just means and in Canada, but so that really just means Australia, New Zealand, and then Germany has always been like a healthy and robust market. So sometimes we hold back there, but again, it varies so much project to project. I don't want to cast a generalization that I think is very fluid.
No, that makes sense. So pivoting a little bit, I'm curious, like, what is a day-to-day existence for you as an executive?
Sure.
Who are you engaging with? What type of people? Like, what are you doing?
Every day is very different. And it really depends on how many plates we have spinning at a given moment, what phase of production or in their process they are. But... you know, I think a typical day I'm reading a script. I try to have like a general meeting with somebody every day just to continue to sort of build a network and keep a finger on the pulse of what people are doing. Sometimes that's a writer or a filmmaker. Sometimes that's an executive at another company. And then generally like kind of looking at a big board in my office of what the projects are and figuring out what needs to be moved forward in a given day. And sometimes that's okay. I've got to follow up on these director submissions, or I've got to make these director submissions. Sometimes it's notes on a project that's in script form or a project that's in post. I mean, sometimes it's going to the mix stage to hear, a playback and give feedback, or, you're flying out to, you know, God knows where, to help manage a crisis with production. So every day is really different. And that's kind of one of the things I love about the job.
How much do you, a lot of your discussion has been focused on sort of the production and development processes. I'm curious how distribution and marketing figure into what you're doing, if at all. Like, are you involved with any of the testing or research or any of that sort of thing?
We definitely are. And I think it also depends on at one point we're bringing on a distributor. But with our own projects that are in post, we do test with a recruit audience, like pretty much after, after the, I guess the director's cut's delivered, we will give notes. They will implement those notes. And if everyone's feeling good, we'll test the film to kind of get a broader cross-section of feedback. And doing something similar on projects like Dumb Money that were sort of where the studio got involved at a little bit of an earlier point. And then once we have those distribution partners on board, we are working very closely with them. They might say to an obnoxious degree, to refine the marketing messaging, the trailer, the poster, all of the key art, and sort of their various strategic decisions.
That's helpful. Thank you. So I'm going to pivot to a little of career advice type of stuff first. So okay. For students that are interested in being creative executives, what advice would you give them in terms of things they can do now to learn, prepare, et cetera?
I would say surround yourself with smart and curious people. Be curious yourself. Don't sell yourself short and use your student status for everything it's worth. Go and ask people if you can pick their brain for 5 minutes. Like I said, most people will give you more time than that. And be forthright about what you want to do or what you're curious about. I think if people know what you're looking for, they can help connect the dots for you. And understand that you have time to sort of try things, with the understanding that doing something and then realizing that it's not for you is not the same as like giving up or quitting. And that understanding what you don't want to do is as important as knowing what you do want to do.
Yeah, that's helpful. I'm curious now on the flip side, what advice would you give for those who want to be writers or directors in terms of dealing with people like you and navigating in an effective manner?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's finding that right balance of being tenacious and putting yourself out there with understanding that oftentimes executives are buried in material and have a long list of reading to manage, but working every angle that you can and being, being thoughtful and strategic about what points of contact you might have with somebody. But I think, like, broadly speaking, I think there's so many different ways to skin the cat as a writer and as a director. And frankly, I know a lot of television writers who started at agencies, which I don't think a lot of people would think makes sense, but I think they realized that they could go and work for a television lit agent, and that when their showrunner client needed a showrunner, like a writer's room assistant, that they could find an entry point there. So again, it's like, it's having that North Star and then figuring out, okay, this isn't the exact perfect sort of vehicle that's going to get me there, but it's pointing me in the right direction.
Thanks. I'm curious, you talked a bit about how the indie market is, you know, contracting a bit, and the TV market for that matter. Where do you see like growth opportunities these days in the media industry, whether in terms of professions or areas to create?
That's a really great question. I think there's a lot internationally to mine from the television landscape. You guys might have heard the term local for global with respect to projects like Money Heist, or why am I blanking right now on the Korean
Squid Game.
Sorry. Oh my gosh. How fatally embarrassing. But I think finding, you know, specific viewpoints, surprising storytelling, and embracing that in a way that, you know, works in that local market, but can also catch fire abroad, I think is a really interesting growth area that a lot of people are focused on. Although I think over the last, you know, year, even that has started, like, I think people are wondering whether that bubble will pop anytime soon, but for the moment, it seems to be an area that people are excited about. And I think there are various international markets like Australia, where there's heavy government investment in and frankly mandating that streamers reinvest an appropriate portion of their profits back into local production, and where there are really attractive rebates, and you can construct something that again, like, is will have a lot of government support behind it for that local market, but feels accessible in its own right for an international audience.
And actually, because you'd brought up soft money earlier and sort of these kinds of rebates and opportunities, where are the big sort of places that you look, or other, you know, production companies look to maximize incentives?
Yeah, I think Canada is an obvious one for us because we have a Canadian distribution company with their own production services arm. And there are not only, like, there's not only government funding, but there are other resources outside of just the tax rebate where you can get like $1 million for your project. Australia and New Zealand are big ones. Eastern Europe has become a really attractive place where the dollar goes really far. And it's less about the rebate and more about just the cost of doing business being significantly lower. So films like Barbarian and a handful of others are looking to those areas to maximize. I would say those are sort of the usual scenarios. And then I think within the US, you know, we're looking at Louisiana, at Alabama. I think Carolina and Utah can sometimes be outliers. I would love to steer some things towards Texas. But yeah, those are kind of the usual suspects as we game various scenarios to figure out where our money is going to go furthest.
Interesting. Some different states than I've heard other people mention. So I haven't heard Utah, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's admittedly, we haven't filmed anything in Utah, but it seems like there are a few good crews there. And if you're shooting something on stages and you're able to sort of like tap in there, it seems to be a pretty attractive option for a lot of things that we've been looking at lately.
Cool. Okay. So I'm going to ask one or two more questions, and one big one and then one small one.
Okay.
And then open up for the audience. So my first question is, what do you recommend that students might do now to sort of prepare themselves? Like, what can they read? What can they learn? You mentioned broadly, like, have a curiosity and networking and that sort of thing. But are there other sort of tangible suggestions you might have?
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, having a finger on the pulse of what's going on in the industry and reading the trades, even if it's just like the Variety Daily and perusing those headlines on a daily basis, can be huge in terms of just getting you oriented to who the players are, what the trends are, what's selling. I think there are a ton of great books like Disney War and sort of and The Mailroom, and it's the little things that are, you know, like part self-help, part Hollywood history, that I think can be really attractive. And then I would think, understanding and being able to speak to your taste, I think is super important, because when you sit down to interview with somebody for an internship, they're going to ask you, most of what you're going to be doing is writing script coverage. And they want to know that you not only have good creative instincts, but that you have a handle on how to articulate them, both verbally and, you know, in writing. And so it's going to sound crazy, but like rehearsing at all levels of my career has been a tremendous, although I maybe should have done some of that before this today, has been a tremendous sort of tool for me. Knowing that like I'm going to go into a Monday morning weekend read meeting with my boss and have to talk about 7 scripts that I read in a tizzy, and which ones are clear passes and which ones I actually like and want him to pay attention to, and how am I going to set the table to convey that? So I think practicing pitching, practicing writing script coverage, which I know we did in our screenwriting classes, is an invaluable tool. A lot of internships are even going to ask you to do sample coverage for them before they offer you a job. And I know it sounds incredibly unglamorous, but even though I don't write script coverage today, I'm writing like some form of it when I read something that I love. I'll send a synopsis and my thoughts about what it is and what it could be, to try to get my colleagues excited about it so that we can, you know, form a coalition around it and hopefully pursue it.
That's a great answer. Thank you. So my final question is, what are you watching these days?
It's a great question too. My wife and I have a 7-month-old, so our viewing habits have changed dramatically over the last little while. We just finished Sex Ed, which was a tearful affair. We're watching Loki now, but there are nights where we don't have enough mental gas in the tank to follow Loki, so we'll watch like the David Beckham documentary series. It's a mix of like what feels like, I guess, like homework in terms of like a director sample that you've got to watch, like, or things that you know you need to sort of watch out of your own curiosity and enthusiasm, but also because everyone's going to talk about it. Like, we're going to have to figure out getting a babysitter so we can go see Killers of the Flower Moon. And then there's this stuff that like, it's like, you know, what do they call it? Like deliberate defocusing, where you're like, okay, I sort of need to switch my brain off and watch something a little bit vacuous to lull me to sleep.
Yeah. That, it sounds like a good breadth of content. Wait till you get to all the kids stuff you're going to be watching soon, right?
I'm not thrilled about Cocomelon, but we'll.
That seems like a good place to end. And I thank you so much, Christopher, for your incredible generosity and for coming in and answering all these questions.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Media Industry Conversations. This has been a co-production of the Department of Radio, Television, Film and the Center for Entertainment and Media Industries in the Moody College of Communication at the University of Texas at Austin. For more information, please visit rtf.utexas.edu/mic and follow the Center for Entertainment and Media Industries on LinkedIn and Instagram. This series was made possible by the work of Dr. Elisa Perrin and Cindy McCreary with the assistance of Keith Berner, Christina Brunning, Laura Brown, Paxton Haven, and Maggie McGinnis. This program was co-produced and edited by Sophia Abbey and me, Hannah Wold. We hope you join us next time for another Media Industry Conversation.